Evening, everybody. Thanks for being here. Good to see you all. Especially Sue, who is zooming in apparently from her hospital bed in Willits, where she was staying at her cabin up there and fell down and broke her hip, and they had to operate on her, and she's in the hospital up there. So, I can't believe you're here with us, but I'm glad you are, and glad you're okay. You'll be home, I guess, as soon as you can. So that just goes to show you, anything could happen at any time. Well, I hope that all of you have been having a good time with the sutra. I've been having a good time sticking with it, you know, reading a little bit every day, or more than a little bit sometimes, trying to keep pace, you know. And I don't know about you, but when I read it, I lose myself. I'm in another world. And just like when you get up from sitting zazen for a while and look at the world looks a little different, a little more sparkly. And it's like that after you finish reading the sutra, the world looks a little sparkly, a little strange and different. Anyway, I hope that you're having a good experience with it. Since I've been reading it, wherever I go and somebody asks me to talk, I usually end up talking about the sutra. So last Saturday, I was down at Kanando giving the Dharma talk there, and I spoke about the sutra. And in that talk on Saturday, I mentioned that for the first time, I detected some problems with the sutra. And I talked about that down there, about the phenomenon of what happens when you hear religious teachings that might be a little objectionable, because the context of the teachings is so different from ours. And this happens sometimes in all religions. And it's actually a more serious problem than you might think, because on the one hand, we know that our views are limited and conditioned, or at least the Dharma tells us that. Maybe we forget that sometimes, but all our views are limited and conditioned, basically incorrect. And the sutra is going beyond those views. It's really giving us a picture of a world beyond all limitations. So it should be simple, right? We should just override all our problems that we might have with the sutra because our views are limited. But on the other hand, it's not so easy to override our conditioned views as a matter of course. And maybe if we think about it, we might conclude we really don't want to do that in some cases. And it won't really work to just believe in the sutra with some sort of faith, if that faith is going to override something that's deeply ingrained within us. So this is always a problem, you know, how to read religious texts in that sense. So I talked about that on Saturday, and I want to today correct yet another error that I made. For some reason, when I was down there on Saturday, I don't know why, I said that there are 59 spiritual benefactors that Sudhana visits on his pilgrimage. And as we all know, this is not at all the case. There are 53, not 59. I have no idea why the number 59 popped into my head, but it is not correct. Anyway, the reason I mention that is because in one of the passages that I want to bring up this afternoon, this evening, there are also some problems. So we're going to talk about some problems. But before I get to that, I want to back up a little bit and talk in general about the sutra. some things I haven't said before that might be a helpful context to help understand where the sutra is coming from. You might think, oh, there must be commentaries to this sutra, right? Surely there, the ancients have written commentaries. There's a huge commentarial literature in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, very little of which has been translated into English, but some has. And yes, there are commentaries to the Gandavyuha Sutra, this 39th chapter that we're reading. I don't know how many there are, but I know there's at least two that were written in the 8th century. One was written by a Chinese, by a Chan master named Zhengguan, and it is apparently, not in English, but it is apparently a very learned and scholarly translation that's even longer, if you can imagine, than the sutra, which I guess it makes sense. If you're going to comment on the sutra, you ended up with a text that's longer than the sutra, right? And it's possible that no one has ever read that commentary, all of it, you know. But Thomas Cleary, the reason I know about it is because Thomas Cleary mentions it in his introduction. And he says that he consulted it frequently when he made his translation, although he doesn't say he read the whole thing, but he said he consults it frequently. There's another commentary written also in the 8th century by a contemporary of Zhengguan named Li Tongxuan, who is, as I say, a contemporary. And this one is much more manageable. It's shorter and it's simpler, and in fact has been translated by Thomas Cleary under the title of Entry into the Realm of Reality, The Guide. And it has the same cover exactly as Entry into the Realm of Reality, the sutra itself, but it's a much shorter book because it isn't actually even a translation of Li Tongxuan's commentary. It's actually the translation of an abridgment of his commentary that was made in several centuries later in the Ming Dynasty. So it's a pretty short book, and it gives you a kind of, it goes, you know, bit by bit through the whole Gandavyuha and gives some commentaries. And I'm going to read you right now the first page of his commentary where he talks about the title, Entry into the Realm of Reality. So I'm going to read you one page. And this is Cleary's translation. The inherent baselessness of physical and mental objects is called reality. The interpenetration of one and many, the disappearance of the boundaries of the real and the artificial, of affirmation and negation, is called realm. So the fact that, so the baselessness, the fact that things have no basis at all, that's called reality. And the fact that there's no real difference between things, real, artificial, yes, no, these are not really different, that's called the realm. Also, the realm that is purely concomitant with knowledge and not with emotional perceptions is called the realm of reality. And here, emotional perceptions means incorrect, afflicted perceptions, which we just now learn is the same as knowledge, not any different from true knowledge, and that's called the realm of reality. Furthermore, actually to realize that the seeds of unenlightened consciousness are purely functions of knowledge and are not subsumed by delusion is the sphere of independent knowledge and is called the realm of reality. So, unenlightened consciousness is not delusion. Our human confusion is not delusion. It is a function of knowledge, and it is called the realm of reality. What is more, since the substance of knowledge has no abode and is all pervasive, one sees the absolute and the mundane to be, the absolute and the mundane, to be totally inconceivable. In the infinite realm, where all beings and objects reflect one another, Buddha lands are multiplied and remultiplied, sages and ordinary people are the same whole, and the forms of objects interpenetrate. This is called the realm of reality. And when one subtle sound pervades the universe, a single hair measures infinity, views of great and small disappear, others and self are the same body, conditioned consciousness and feelings are gone, and knowledge pervades without obstruction. This is called entry into the realm of reality. So that's why just a moment can open this up, because it just one subtle sound pervades the universe, and a single moment dissolves everything. So that's rather, I mean, you could study that one page for a long time and think about that for a long time, but I thought it would be interesting to share his commentary, that one page from the commentary, which I found actually very illuminating and inspiring. Now, there's more to this commentary that's really worth mentioning. In it, Cleary, in his introduction to this little commentary, Cleary points out that the Gandavyuha Sutra is not, as we might imagine, a more or less improvised series of stories riffing on various Mahayana teachings and worldview. It does have a system to it. And it turns out that it is, this would be hard to detect this on our own, so we're lucky we have this commentary, because the commentary tells us that the Gandavyuha is actually a summary and a recapitulation of the most important parts of the rest of the Avatamsaka Sutra. So it makes sense, right? This sutra goes 38 chapters with all these really important teachings, and in the 39th chapter there would be a kind of review and recapitulation in another way. In other words, and so that's what's actually going on in this sutra. We haven't mentioned that before, but that's what's going on. So 53 teachers, the first 10 teachers Sudana visits represent the 10 abodes, which is a teaching that's detailed in the 15th book of the sutra. And these abodes are, first, the abode of initial inspiration or initial determination. And this is sort of like a stepwise progress, you know, of the bodhisattva path. So the first abode is initial inspiration, initial determination, bodhicitta. The second abode is preparing the ground, which involves cultivating compassion and dedication to others. The third is the abode of practice, which involves contemplating the real nature of things, going beyond ordinary limited views and seeing how cosmic everything really is. Fourth is the abode of noble birth, which gives the bodhisattva access to all the Buddhas, because this bodhisattva is now literally born into their family and so is a family member of all the Buddhas. The fifth abode is skill and means, which is about how to help others as and where they are. The sixth abode is unwavering state of mind, in which the bodhisattva has a stable mind. No matter how much they're praised or reviled, their mind doesn't move. No matter how difficult conditions are, they have an unwavering mind. The seventh abode is called non-regression. And at this stage, it is absolutely impossible for bodhisattvas to ever backslide in their practice. The eighth abode is called youthful nature or innocence. As I often say, you know, the bodhisattvas are inherently innocent, naive, and childlike. They have a buoyant attitude, no matter what. The ninth abode is spiritual royalty, in which the Bodhisattva understands all beings and all their conditions and all their motivations and all the teachings that will be just right for them. And the tenth abode is coronation, in which the Bodhisattva understands and visits and purifies not only one world, but all worlds at the same time. So those are the 10 stages that are represented by the first 10 teachers. The next 10 teachers Sudana visits represents the 10 practices described in the 21st book of the sutra, which are the 10 main practices for all bodhisattvas, the 10 paramitas, which we know about, we've heard about already. although in this case, the sutra discusses those 10 in slightly different ways from the usual way. For instance, the first paramita, giving or generosity, is emphasized in the sutra as joy. That we are joyful and that we spread joy. That's our great gift, is our gift of joy. The third paramita, as another example, is patience or tolerant forbearance. And in this case, it's called non-opposition. In other words, full cooperation all the time with whatever is going on, whether it seems to be good or bad, you cooperate. The fourth, which is always called energy or joyful effort, is here called indomitability. The sixth, Prajnaparamita, wisdom beyond wisdom, our old friend, in this case is called non-confusion, and so on. So ten paramitas are tweaked and discussed a little differently. So this is about where we are now in the sutra, around the 20th teacher out of 53. And in the translation, probably because it's the case in the sutra itself, Cleary doesn't mention the, doesn't number the teachers, 1, 2, 3, 4. But if you Google it, if you say, who are the 53 teachers that Sudana visits, you'll get a list, a numbered list. And so now I want to say something about teachers numbers 16, 17, and 18. Samantanetra, number 16, and 17 and 18, Anala and Mahaprabha, both of whom are kings. So Samantanetra is, interestingly enough, a perfumer. Right? A perfumer. He's an expert on perfumes and manufactures all kinds of scents. Why would one of the teachers be a perfumer? Well, I suppose that in those days, a perfumer was something like a kind of a version or a variety of an herbalist. Someone who, instead of making potions that would be ingested, makes potions that would be sniffed. And that these potions would have all kinds of properties, some healing properties and other kinds of properties. As we learn in the sutras, Samantanetra knows how to make a miraculous ball of fragrance that is one of the most wonderful possible offerings for the Buddha. Remember that in the sutra, one of the things that bodhisattvas always do is visit many Buddhas and serve many Buddhas, and in doing so, they always make offerings to those Buddhas. That's a very, very important practice for bodhisattvas, their sense of devotion and gratitude to their spiritual benefactors, and they're encouraging the spiritual benefactors to remain alive as long as possible and give teachings. Because bodhisattvas are very devoted and respectful and always wanting to learn more about the teachings, remember, Sudana, with every teacher, he's like starts all over again from the beginning. He asks the same question each time, with just as much enthusiasm every time. So bodhisattvas are very joyful when they find a spiritual benefactor, and they naturally want to make offerings to them. And the offerings are made of things that have to do with the five senses. All the things that are described, right? All the extravagant stuff that's described in the sutra so poetically, it's all stuff of the five senses. Gorgeous banners and parasols and palaces and jewels and so on for sense of sight. There's music and bells and all kinds of celestial chorales and so on for the sense of hearing. There's food and so on for taste, although less of that, I think, somehow than the other senses, but it's there. And soft fabrics and fancy robes and stuff like that for touch. And, of course, wonderful fragrances. And that's why we always offer incense and flowers at services, to offer something visually beautiful. And flowers also have a scent, maybe, sometimes, not all flowers, but they do. But incense always has a beautiful scent. So we offer fragrances to the Buddha, and, you know, if you really get into the priest business far enough, you can become like a connoisseur of better kinds of incense for special ceremonies, you know, these kind of incenses for this kind of ceremony and so on. Because making offerings to the Buddha is a big deal. Now, to me, I really like this because it reminds me of how this comes down in our practice in a very concrete and a way that you might not expect. I mean, I think, and maybe I'm wrong about this because I don't know a lot of stuff, but I don't know any other religion besides Buddhism that features an analysis of the senses and how they work to make the world and the self. The whole way about how the senses and consciousness work to create a world is really in a very important discussion in Buddhism. So the senses, the five senses, and of course six senses with the mind as a sixth sense, are really, really important and much discussed. So in Zen practice, the way that we offer the five senses to the Buddha is by fully engaging and living and appreciating the five senses as they really are. Not ours and not objective. So in our own plain and concrete way, we offer our five senses to the Buddha by appreciating them. When you hear a sound, or look at something, or taste something, or hear maybe say the sound of the ocean, or moving water, or the wind, and you really, really pay attention without being distracted by worrying about yourself or something, you get really close to those experiences. And that, I mean, it's very intimate to listen to something, see something, you know. And that intimacy feels as if the sensual experience, that is, the sense and the object and the consciousness, are one profound moment that is actually out of this world or beyond this world. You feel that in your sensual experience when your mind is quiet. The senses and the world they bring us are so dear and precious. I mean, it is beyond everything. You know, just that, think of that. You know, that you can see something and see its beauty. It's beyond everything. It's so precious. And when we live that way and we feel that once in a while, that's for us what it is to make an offering to the Buddha. So this is a really important practice that we do. And I'm mentioning it because you might not have noticed it, and it's such a great practice, and I really encourage you to do it because it'll make you so happy to quiet your mind as much as you can all the time if possible. And pay attention to the sounds and smells and sights and sensation of this world very closely, including sensations in your own body. I mean, it's an immense thing walking across a room, right? It's an immense experience that you can offer to the Buddha by just doing it fully. And if you practice this way as often as possible, I know you'll be a very happy person. You'll have a lot of happiness. It's a brilliant thing. And this is how I think in Zen we practice what this sutra is talking about. So we learn that Samantanetra uses these perfumes that he makes to cure people. He uses them to cure their illnesses. And then after he cures them and they're perfectly all right, then he gives them clothes, he gives them food, he takes care of them. And once they're okay, he then helps them gently, probably, to see the disadvantages of the ordinary world with its many, many problems, built-in problems, you know, and the virtues of the Buddhas who transcend these problems. And once they see that, they are very encouraged to practice, and so he teaches them the 10 paramitas. And then, now that they have everything they need, he sends them on their way. That's what Samantanetra does. So now I bring up the next two teachers, Anala and Mahaprabha, the kings. And these are interesting because they are examples of specifically and directly bodhisattvas in the political world. These are rulers, right, who have responsibility for kingdoms. And we would think we're interested in politics, right? And how to manage the world in the best way. So how do these bodhisattvas do it? So that's interesting. How do they exercise political power as bodhisattvas? So now I'm going to quote to you some of the sutra, and I'm reading on page 119. Now, if you are accessing the online version of the sutra, the one that was in the link, it's the same text, except the pagination is totally different, because instead of starting at the beginning, page one, like this separate text does, it is considering the Gandavyuha as a continuation of the whole rest of the sutra. So I think the Gandavyuha begins on page 1120-something or other. On the link. So, in this, I don't mean to make this too complicated, but in this text, the sutra itself, after all the introductions and blah, 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 starts on page 11, right? So page 119 would be roughly, what's 19, 119 minus 11 is 108? So we're 108 pages in. So you'd have to start from whatever page is the beginning and go 108 pages. Anyway, if that's worth, I don't know if that's worthwhile for you, but because I'm giving you the page that may not compute, but it's page 119 if you have the same volume I have. So anyway, King Alana is on the throne. Anala, I mean, is on the throne carrying out his royal duties for the welfare of the populace. And Sudana goes to him and sees him sitting on a great jeweled lion throne, brilliant with diamonds, set on legs of countless varieties of luminous jewels, with beautiful figurines inlaid with jewels, arrayed with cowrie shells on golden threads, lit by many jewel lamps, in a lotus calyx made of magic gems, spread with many precious celestial robes, perfumed with various celestial incenses, embellished with 100,000 jeweled parasols, adorned with 100,000 jeweled banners. And it goes on much further to describe the throne where he's sitting. Sudana saw, gathered around this king, Anala, 10,000 ministers conducting the affairs of state. He also saw 10,000 torturers before the king, looking like warders of hell, of violent, terrifying appearance, holding swords, axes, spears, clubs, and impaling stakes, involved in punishing those to be punished. He saw criminals, thieves, bandits, murderers, troublemakers, rapists, and so on, brought bound before King Anala, and saw the king deal out appropriate punishments. By the king's order, some had their hands and feet cut off, some had their ears and noses cut off, some had their eyes gouged out, some had their limbs or heads cut off, some had their whole bodies burnt by fire. Some were dismembered, burnt, sprinkled with acid. Sudana watched them undergoing such harsh, injurious, and deadly punishments and saw a mountainous heap of rendered body parts on the execution ground and a tremendous torrent of blood. And it goes on from there. Well, this is the part I was talking about that gives us some trouble. Did you feel a little trouble with that passage? I did. I was not. I was thinking, this is how bodhisattvas rule? This is the recommended bodhisattva method? Really? I mean, I'm sure that at the time the sutra was written, those forms of punishment were, in fact, used. But don't you think a bodhisattva would have a different approach? Well, Sudana has exactly the same doubts that we have, as it says here. Seeing that dreadful, horrifying butchery, Sudana thought, "I have set out for supreme perfect enlightenment for the sake of the welfare and happiness of all beings, and am devoted to pursuing the practice of enlightening beings. I ask spiritual benefactors what good an enlightening being should do and what evil one should avoid. This King Anala, though, is devoid of goodness. He's an evildoer, a malicious killer and oppressor without regard for others, doomed to a miserable fate. So how can I hear about the practice of enlightening beings from him?" And as Sudana was thinking this, concerned with saving all sentient beings, his mind full of compassion, celestial beings in the sky over his head called out, "Do you not remember the instructions of the seer Jayushmayatana?" And Sudana looked up and said, "Yes, I do." The celestial said, "Do not give rise to doubts about the instructions of spiritual benefactors. They guide you on the right way. Indeed, the practical knowledge of skill in means of enlightening being is inconceivable." So maybe you remember that we talked about the Jayushmayatana when that came up. He was the one who told Sudana to climb a mountain of razor sharp edge, get to the top and leap off into the abyss. And at that time too, Sudana said, "Whoa, that doesn't sound good." And many people came and said, no, you don't understand. You should do this." And he did it, and it turned out to be that it was just fine. It was no problem to do this. So Sudana, maybe us too, we should suspend our small-minded judgments, give up our various conditioned ideas about what's right and wrong, what is compassion, what is kindness, and realize that the view of the bodhisattvas and Buddhas is inconceivable. And in a way, okay, you could say, yes, if I think about that, that does make sense, but it is very hard to give up the idea, isn't it, that these punishments are really cruel and objectionable. It's hard to say, yes, go ahead. I see, I don't understand. Bodhisattvas can go ahead and do that stuff. Don't you find that? Yeah, it's hard to say that's okay. Limited views or not. Something in us doesn't, just like Sudhana, you know, we don't like that. But King Anala actually has an answer to this. King Anala has an answer that the sutra considers to be the solution to this problem. So here's King Anala's answer. After he's finished with all these brutal but helpful duties, helpful he thinks, duties, he gets off his throne and he says to Sudhana, come over to my house. And he takes Sudhana over to his house. And his house is, need we even say, fabulous. Unbelievable furnishings, terraces of various jewels emblazoned with hundreds of thousands of towers, blazing with the radiance of inconceivable numbers of jewels, pillars made of jewels, and so on. I don't have to read it for you. You get the picture. And then King Anala says to Sudhana, so look at this house. He says, what do you think? Could such fruit of karmic action come to someone who was actually a villain and a rotten person? Could a villain ever achieve a condition like this? And Sudhana says, well, I guess not. And then the king says, I have attained enlightened beings' magical liberation. The people in my realm are given to all sorts of evil doing: murder, theft, rape, falsehood, slander, vilification, divisive talk, covetousness, malice, false views, villainy, violence, cruelty. I am unable to turn them away from evil doing by any other means. So, in order to subdue them, mature them, guide them, and secure their welfare out of compassion, I have illusory executioners kill and maim illusory criminals, making a display of intense suffering and pain, which is totally illusory. Seeing this, the people in my realm become afraid to do evil. And seeing people alarmed by this device, I have them give up evil doing and conduct themselves virtually, and I establish them in ultimate security and bliss and omniscience and practice. I don't do anything bad. None of these things that look like are bad are bad. They're all illusory. Even in a dream I would never think of doing something evil. So that's his explanation. So that makes it okay, right? So in the opening part of the passage where he shows him his house, this is something that is sort of, you see in all throughout Buddhist literature, that I think we people of the modern era find a little hard to accept. The idea that all present conditions are due to causes and conditions of the past. Nothing that happens now is not due to those causes and conditions of the past. Now that, as a general rule, is not a problem, of course. Yes, we agree with that, of course. But when you bring it down to individual cases, it becomes very hard to accept. If someone is destitute and suffers a lot, that must be due to their causes and conditions created in the past. So in a way, people in unfortunate situations kind of deserve those situations. Not really, but sort of, you know, it's just because of what they did in the past, their past lives. And the implication is, well, you know, it's lamentable and we're compassionate toward them, but there's really nothing to be done. Unfortunate victims kind of got what they need to get. It's sad, but it can't be helped. Conversely, as in the case of King Anala, when you have a lot of wealth and advantage, it can only be because your actions of the past have been just and good and wonderful. So King Anali is saying here very directly that if he has this fabulous house and this amazing wealth, that's proof that everything he's doing as a ruler must be right. Because otherwise he wouldn't be wealthy if they were wrong, these things. And there are people who think this now, you know. There are people who think, you know, that if you're very, very wealthy, the only reason that could be is that you're a just and good and righteous person to be admired and emulated. So all rich people should be admired because they're really good. They must be very good. I think they call this the prosperity gospel or something like that. There's a whole religion about this. And of course, then there are lots of people, just as many, if not more, who feel exactly the opposite. If you are fabulously wealthy, really, really wealthy, beyond, you know, well off, but really, really wealthy, there's only one reason for that. Some way or the other, whether it's legal or illegal, you're a crook, right? You got to be a crook to be that wealthy. There's no other way. So we don't go along with the old Buddhist idea, but that is definitely universal in all the sutras. But that aside, the next part is even more problematic. Although he seems to be actually causing his minions to cut off hands and ears and noses, it looks like that to Sudana, the king is saying, actually, no, that's just illusory. He's not harming anyone. He would never do such a thing. It's just a magic show, a dream, a kind of morality drama to frighten people into the true way to behave. And it's working. People are, you know, learning to practice and be good because, you know, he succeeded in frightening them into it. Well, the trouble is that it's hard to know how exactly to understand what the king is saying here. The use of the word illusory is a trick word, you know? It's a trick word, illusory, in Mahayana Buddhism. Because, according to Mahayana Buddhism, the ordinary world, this real world we live in which it certainly appears to us that people really are being killed in wars and shot in schools or raped or being caused to starve to death or arrested and sent to detention camps and sent to foreign countries, we are told in the sutras that this world is illusory. It's like a dream, a fantasy, a dewdrop, a bubble. It's not really real. So the trouble with the word illusory as it's used in Mahayana Buddhism is that it doesn't really mean exactly what we usually think of by the use of the word illusory. Illusory means exactly not real. Illusory is the opposite of real. The word illusory, as we understand it, only means illusory when real means real. But in Mahayana Buddhism, the word illusory covers everything. There is no real thing that's not illusory. This material and psychological world, as well as all the Buddha realms of the Avatamsaka Sutra, are all illusory. The Avatamsaka Sutra isn't saying this world is real and the other world is not. It's saying all these worlds are equally illusory. All worlds are illusory. There's nothing that is not illusory. If there's nothing that is real and everything is illusory, what does the word illusory mean? And what does the king mean when he says, well, these are only illusory killings and punishments? And the reason I make such a big deal out of this is because I think about this all the time, because it has to do with how we hold in our hearts the suffering of the human world. This is a really big deal, you know, because on the one hand, because we value compassion so much, we certainly do care about suffering, our own suffering and that of our friends and that of everybody. And we're anguished by this suffering and we want to alleviate it. We do everything we could to alleviate it. At the same time, if we're really going to care about the suffering, all of the suffering, and not distract ourselves from it, it really could be quite debilitating. It really could be devastating. It would mean, really, that no happiness is possible. That if you have a moment of happiness, the only way that could be so is that in that moment you are ignoring the suffering. And you should stop ignoring the suffering and stop being happy and go back to anguish. Because there is so much suffering. We read about some suffering, we know about some suffering, but there's way, way more than we could ever even take in. On the other hand, as the king is saying here, if everything is illusory, we should see that all suffering is illusory suffering perpetrated for the purpose of straightening us out, helping us on our path, which in a way seems kind of wonderful and comforting and absolutely monstrous, on the other hand. So this is our dilemma, and it reminds me of our sending and receiving practice, which I know many of you do. I do it a lot, actually. The more suffering there is in the world, the more I'm inspired to do this practice of sending and receiving. And when I breathe in this practice, I breathe in the suffering. And it is not a good thing. I'm not sitting there happy about it, right? I'm breathing in the horrible, dismal, terrible suffering. And I have a heavy and a sad feeling for the suffering of those actual people. I remind myself all the time that there are actual people just like me who are going through these things. These are not cartoon figures, you know. They're actual people. But when I breathe out, the suffering is dissolved. The suffering has been transformed into peacefulness. And then I can breathe out that suffering and send it to those who are, breathe out that peacefulness, and I can send it to those who are in need. So the imaginative practice of sending and receiving actually is an enactment of this two-sided and problematic and impossible to understand, really, nature of suffering. Of course, I don't know this, but I believe that at the heart of suffering there is a deep peace and a total quiescence. This doesn't mean that suffering isn't suffering, that suffering does not need to be alleviated, or that suffering should be welcomed when it comes. But feeling that way does help me to accept the suffering that does exist in its many, many forms, and to face it and to keep going. Anyway, forever. Knowing that the suffering is there for a reason. A reason that maybe we human beings will never be able to fathom. But maybe through our practice over a lifetime, we will come to have some appreciation of what this all means. Well, I don't want to leave you there, because the next spiritual teacher is also a king, right? King Mahaprabha. And he has a very different approach, as you'll see in a moment. So I think this sutra is trying to tell us that don't set up a set of standards that you think bodhisattvas are supposed to conform to, because it takes all kinds. There are lots of conditions in this world, very different from each other, and so different sorts of methodologies will be needed. Sometimes they might look objectionable. I remember in the beginning of this talk, I was quoting the commentary correlating the various teachers with various teachings. So in this case, if my calculations are correct, and as you realize, I'm quite often mistaken, but I think that it's right, that King Anala corresponds to the seventh paramita, the practice of upaya, skill and means. And King Mahaprabha corresponds to the eighth paramita, vows, the vow to spread universal goodness to all. And so this might account for the difference between the two kings. And as you will hear in a second, King Mahaprabha doesn't have the same kind of citizens in his kingdom that King Anala has. His citizens are not so difficult to get along with and difficult to convince to be good. So he has a little bit easier time of it. So I'm going to read a little bit of this and then I'll stop. Now I'm on page 123. So again, he finds King Mahaprabha at the crossroads, sitting on an equally magnificent throne, which is described in great detail. And he goes up to the king and asks him his usual question, the same question he asks all the benefactors, that he wants to, he's dedicated to complete awakening, and he doesn't know how to learn and do the practices of enlightening beings. And he hears that, I've heard that you have good instructions, and so I'm asking you to tell me how to study and how to accomplish the practice of enlightening beings. And the king says, I purify and fulfill the enlightening beings' practice, which is characterized by great benevolence. The practice I have asked about, purified, ordered, observed, carried out, pursued, entered into, diversified and expanded in the company of hundreds, thousands, millions, indeed untold numbers of Buddhas. Based on this enlightening practice of great benevolence, I command kingship justly. I treat the world justly. I pass through the world justly. I lead the people justly. I bring justice to people and turn them to the sphere of right. I give them right guidance. I saturate them with justice. I direct them to the attainment of what is right. I get them to contemplate the nature of things. I establish people in kindness, in great kindness, in the power of kindness, in altruism, in goodwill, in sympathy, in friendliness, in hospitality, in determination to get rid of all suffering, in conduct conducive to ultimate happiness. I cool their minds and remove their mental tangles by producing the bliss of cessation. I divert their continuity of mind attached to delight in mundane routines and purify it in enjoyment of the pleasures of truth. I purify them of all unwholesome qualities and turn them away from what is not good. I turn back the flow of the mundane whirl. I turn back the flow of the mundane world. Furthermore, no one leaves my presence feeling intimidated, threatened, or frightened. If any poor people lacking in means of subsistence came to me seeking food or drink or clothing or any other need, I open the royal storehouse to them and allow them to take from there or from the streets and crossroads of the city whatever they need, things they would otherwise get involved in wrongdoing to get. Whenever the inhabitants of my domain want to do anything wrong in the degenerate world, their natures disturbed by the times. So that's what goes on a lot, right? Disturbed by the times, people's natures are disturbed, and they seem to have a taste for doing terrible things. When that happens, in order to save them, I go into an enlightening concentration guided by great benevolence called adapting to the faculties of the world. Whereupon their fears, misfortunes, animosities, quarrels, agitations, and hostilities cease. And to show Sudhana how this is done, he does it right then and there on the spot. he enters into this concentration, whereupon the whole city, as well as all the provinces of the kingdom, quaked. In this way, all the fears, misfortunes, animosities, quarrels, agitations, and hostilities of all creatures on earth ceased. And as this happened on earth, so did it also happen throughout the galaxy in as many as 10 duodecillion, if that's a number, duodecillion worlds. So that's how he does it. He just sits in this concentration and poof, no problems. Which may seem hard to manage to do in this world, but maybe the problem still exists because no one has yet tried it. I don't know. It does sort of seem like a fairy tale-like ending, but the whole sutra is kind of a fairy tale, isn't it? On the other hand, of course, the most challenging point that the sutra is over and over again in various ways making, and we heard it in the opening page that I read you from the commentary, is that the world we live in, with all of its troubles and difficulties, is not a world that we transcend in order to enter the realm of reality. It is, in fact, the realm of reality itself. It is not different from the realm of reality. And that's why, of the 53 teachers Sudhana visits, only less than half of them are religious persons or monastics. They're perfumers, as we saw, they're kings, as we just saw tonight, all kinds of people. Because, wild as it may seem, the realm of reality with all its Buddhas and jewel towers is this world, right in front of us. That's why just paying attention to the senses as they are is offering the senses to Buddha, like I said before. So that is our challenge, to understand and accept this world exactly as it is on all levels. All levels, not have our head in the sky and think we're in jeweled pedestals, but not think that we're not in jeweled pedestals. We notice this world and all its messiness, and we pick up after one another, but we don't think that that's the whole of the world. We have to understand this world on all levels of reality and accept the world exactly as it is on all levels and live in it for the benefit of everyone. We're not supposed to reject anything. We have to include absolutely everything. And that's why the king's concentration is not called going beyond the faculties of the world. It's called adapting to the faculties of the world, because the world is the realm of reality. So that is what I wanted to share with you for this week. And that's a lot. One more. Before I run out of steam, I'll probably have one more thing to say like this on Saturday at the all-day sit. Come if you can, online or in person. And next week, a week from tonight, is the second Wednesday of the month, which means we'll be in person at the church, and I'm hoping that lots of you will come, because it's going to be a special occasion. We're going to enact the Avatamsaka Sutra by taking a regular chair and making it into a jeweled throne on which we're going to put Eva Bavenzi, and she's going to be elevated to the state of a lay Zen teacher in a ceremony that we will perform together. And it'll be a kind of like way of our pretending that the world is just like the Avatamsaka Sutra, as opposed to pretending that it's not. So please come next Wednesday if you can at 5 o'clock. The ceremony will be at the regular time of seminar. Those of you who attend the seminar online, I would encourage you to come and see Eva take this step, because as we already know from the Avatamsaka Sutra, this is not just about Eva. I mean, wonderful as Eva is, it's the entire Sangha in the entire universe that steps up into this high Dharma seat and advances in practice and understanding. So please come. I don't know how long it'll take. And those of you who come in person, we bribe you. Instead of punishing you in all these ways to convince you, we bribe you instead with a possible, I don't promise anything, but a possible piece of cake and a little reception afterward. So that's next week, and then next Wednesday, Saturday sitting, Wednesday the ceremony, and the following Wednesday we'll be back to the sutra, and we'll be back online. And somehow I would like to figure out how to get a number of you, whoever has access to the sutra and feels like you would want to read a page of the sutra that's one of your favorite passages, I'd like to have that next meeting be different and have at least 4 or 5 of you, if not more, read a page of the sutra. And you can choose whatever section you want to choose. Could be anywhere in the sutra. And if two people choose the same one, I don't think it makes any difference, because we could hear it twice and we wouldn't know the difference, and it would be a different voice. So how are we going to do this? How about if you want to do this, you feel like you're going to be there, that's 2 weeks from today, and you will be there and you can read the sutra. Can you email Everyday Zen, is that going to work, Laura? Can they email, is that an info@everydayzen address? No, it's another address. Just somehow email the website and Laura will, Laura's muted. She wants to say.
Send it to world.
World at Everyday Zen. So that way, and Laura can give me a list of who wants to read. And then I'll know who to call on. And as I say, just choose your own passage. And it would be nice, I think it would be, not to have lengthy explanations, but if anybody wants to, it's not necessary. If anybody wants to say why this passage speaks to you, you could say that briefly. So maybe we'll have 4 or 5, and if there's lots of people, maybe we'll have more than 4 or 5. Do that next week. I've been wanting to sort of say a lot in the beginning to orient you to the sutra, but now that I've done that, more or less, I can say less, at least for a while. So, okay? So, with that, we have not so much time, so what I would like to do is not have groups tonight, but open up the floor to anybody who wants to speak, and maybe some of you have been continuing with this practice of jotting down phrases that you hear in the talks or in the sutra as you read. So if anybody has a phrase from the sutra that they would like to bring up, let's start with that and raise your hand. You know how to do that electronically under reactions. And or if you have a comment of some other kind.
Recording stopped.
Bring that up.